You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
In the 1970s, Paul Theroux set out from London and looped by train across Eastern Europe, the Middle East, and Far East Asia, and then back again. He wrote about that trip in the acclaimed travel narrative, The Great Railway Bazaar. And now, 33 years later, he took the same, or not now, but recently, he took that same voyage again. And the changes he saw are the subject of his latest book called Ghost Train to the Eastern Star on the Tracks of the Great Railway Bazaar. It's published by Houghton Mifflin. I'm very pleased that it has brought Paul Theroux back to the show. Hi.
Hi, how you doing?
So why did you decide to take that trip again more than 30 years after the first time?
I discovered that travelers took trips and never repeated the trip. They would someone would go to Brazil, like Peter Fleming in the 1930s, and never go back. Graham Greene went to West Africa and never went back.
But they write a book. So
they write a book. And
people go back with them in a way.
Yes, but it's a portrait of a place at a particular time, but places change. And the traveler himself or herself changes. So I wrote a book about going through Africa, Dark Star Safari. I started in Cairo, ended up in Cape Town. And I returned to the place where I had been a Peace Corps volunteer. And of the whole trip, you know, from Egypt to South Africa, the place that meant the most to me, that that had changed the most, the most unexpected, was the place that I thought I knew best. So I thought the literature of revisitation is thin. The shelf is small. And very few – Henry Morton Stanley crossed Africa twice. Naipaul went to India a couple of times – well, three times actually, three books. And they're very revealing. So I thought, I'm going to revisit the book that I wrote, that I published in 1975.
Well, I'm sure you, from what you just said, suspected that a lot had changed. But were the places you could no longer visit? Because politics has changed the world as well.
That's absolutely true. So I couldn't get an Iranian visa. And I had gone through Afghanistan the first time. So this time I had to become more creative as far as the itinerary went. And I went from Turkey, Georgia, Azerbaijan, Turkmenistan, Uzbekistan, then down into India. As a result, I saw places that I hadn't anticipated. And I was going to places for the first time. Georgia's in the news, has been recently in the news, but I was there before then. So I realized this is quite a strange place. I mean,
you got no sense that that all of this stuff was going to happen?
The sense I had was that the Georgians are the most Russophobic people I'd ever come across. They hate them. But then the Russians had turned off the natural gas supply. And the winter that I was there, people were burning sticks by the side of the road to keep warm. So
and they have a very odd relations with Russians because they were the major supplier of wines to the old Soviet Union, and with all the tensions, that was cut off as well. But they supplied the Soviet Union with its most notorious leader, Joseph
Absolutely.
Stalin.
That's right.
And they're still proud of Stalin despite the fact that they hate the Russians.
They hate the Russians. They're proud of Stalin. Well, Stalin was a choir boy in Gori. When you see his face, you know that here's a man who wrote poetry and probably had a wonderful voice and as a choir boy. He was in the seminary in Gori. I went through Gori. And so, yeah, that's fair. But I thought Georgia is it's a peasant economy. It's got a very pro-American government. And there's this George W. Bush Street in Tbilisi. Anyway, they're also right next door to Azerbaijan, where I went. I mean, I took the train from the edge of Turkey through Gori, Tbilisi, Baku, and then onward to Turkmenistan, which is another place run by a maniac whose fun is putting up gold statues of himself. Mm-hmm. Turkmenbashi, he's called.
Now, he's dead, isn't he?
He died last December. Yeah. But the thing is,
A dentist took over. He may be his son.
He's called Gurbanguly Muhammadov.
Easy for you to say. His name is about 10 lines long.
Well, Gurbanguly Berdi Muhammadov. He took over from Niyazov. Actually, the point is that I would not have gone to these places. I didn't go to them on the Great Railway Bazaar. So I was forced to go to them. And then it turns out they're in the news or they're really amazingly interesting.
Did both trips take about the same amount of time?
No, this one took much longer.
Because you had to go in this detour?
Yeah, big detour. And also I have more money. In 1973, when I actually took the trip, I didn't have any money. I didn't have a credit card. So I was basically just a backpacker. And now I have more money, so I don't have little kids. I wasn't homesick as I was the first time, so I just took my time. That's what I discovered, that places change, but I had changed most of all.
You didn't find much to admire in the parts of Eastern Europe that you traveled through, Hungary, Romania, Bulgaria. Are they worse than they were when they were parts of the communist bloc in 1973?
They seem very demoralized to me, and they're very westward looking. I mean, there are call centers in India, the Tata Group, for example, who are putting up call centers in Romania and in Budapest and in Bucharest, because they are like third world countries. So that there are Indians actually training Hungarians and Romanians to run call centers. In other words, colonizing them in a kind of economic sense.
I'm surprised, because there are so many people I've spoken to who have fallen in love with Budapest.
It's a beautiful city. I mean, yeah, I've no complaint with the city, but I felt underachievers as far as an underachieving economy.
And why do you think that is? After they were freed of the restraints that the old system imposed on them, you would have thought that they would have boomed in the same way that China has boomed.
Some places do, some don't. I think that Eastern Europe and Russia is an example of, and I found it in Albania. The first thing that happens after people become politically free is they have a lot of dissent, and they publish their dissent, and they have a lot of newspapers. Then they discover that political dissent and publishing opinions is fine, but publishing pictures of naked women is really much more fun, and it moves very quickly from political freedom to just porno. And so the porno industry in Eastern Europe, in Albania, the skin magazines in Vladivostok proliferate. That is a noticeable fact, that there's more porno and less politics.
And you actually visited a few sex shops and met a few prostitutes along the journey. Is that the sort of research that travel writers are expected to engage in these days?
Not expected to, but if you had, I don't have 15 minutes, but let's say you had 15 minutes to sum up a country, you would go. I would send you to a porno shop to find out what's the private life of the people in this place actually like. Porno, disgusting though it may seem, tells you a great deal about how men treat women, what their lives are like, and what their early life is like. So yeah, it's the shorthand. Porno is the shorthand for the inner life of any country.
And human trafficking for the sex trade has grown significantly over the past 30 years. It was already pretty much in place in parts of Asia, but now Eastern Europe as well has become part of that whole thing.
Eastern Europe is the sex trade, and in fact, sex trafficking there in Turkey, a lot in Turkey, women coming from the Ukraine and from Russia. Then you notice in Southeast Asia, in Thailand and Cambodia, not Vietnam so much, but in Singapore, sanitized, prosperous Singapore has a rip-roaring sex trade.
My guest is Paul Theroux, whose latest book is Ghost Train to the Eastern Star on the Tracks of the Great Railway Bazaar. The book is published by Houghton Mifflin. When you were in Istanbul, you had dinner with the Nobel Prize-winning author Orhan Pamuk. Does talking to writers of fiction give insight that you might not get when you're hanging out with journalists?
I think so. I think so because I'm a novelist. I remember when I was in South America in the 70s, the time I spent with Borges, Jorge Luis Borges in Buenos Aires, was really the most valuable and revealing time that I could possibly have spent, apart from meeting a hero. But then Pamuk hadn't won the Nobel Prize when I met him, and that was fun. He's a very funny guy, and he's a friendly guy, and he's from Istanbul. He wrote a book about Istanbul.
But he also has a very strong sense of how the West sees the country. In fact, in his last book, he quoted Conrad's Under Western Eyes as suggesting that if you live in a country like Turkey, you're both aware of your Asian side and the fact that you're connected to Europe.
Yes, that's true. In fact,
And Istanbul is a perfect example of that because it's on
both
sides.
Yeah, the other example is Baku in Azerbaijan, and there's a great novel set there called Ali and Nino by a man called Kurban Said.
Well, actually by a Jewish guy who
Lev Nussenbaum.
Took that name. Yeah.
Yeah, Lev Nussenbaum became Kurban Said and wrote this book in German. But also, it's the same. Ali, it's this East-West dichotomy. It's fun. But you're asking about writers. I went to Sri Lanka on this trip, and I met Arthur C. Clarke.
How long before he died?
He died this year, so it was I was there about 2 years ago. So he was fading, but still there. I mean, it's elegiac actually talking to him, but no one came to see him. The first time I wanted to see him, and I thought this is the difference between the Great Railway Bazaar and Ghost Train to the Eastern Star, is that the first time I expressed a wish to see him, and they thought, "Who might you be? You know, punk. You want to see him?" This time they said, "Oh yeah, we can fix you up, Paul Theroux. You can see Sir Arthur." So I did that. And then in Japan, I saw Murakami, Haruki Murakami, who took me to a porno. He said, "What do you want to see?" I said, "A porno shop." And also I said, "I want to see the Tokyo that you wrote about in Underground, which is about the sarin attack." So if you're saying, what do writers know? They know their city. It's not so much the peripatetic writer that I'm interested in, but the writer who has a strong sense of place. Borges had it. Faulkner would have had it in Mississippi. Imagine going to Mississippi and seeing Faulkner. Or imagine going around Dublin with James Joyce. Or Zurich with James Joyce, for that matter. But James Joyce and Dublin. There are just these people who know their city or they know their country. I think city located. So Murakami knows Tokyo intimately. And I was lucky that I was able to travel around with these people.
You traveled through a lot of India, passing through Delhi, Jodhpur, Mumbai, Bangalore. What was your impression of India, a country that is really obviously going through an incredible boom? And then I read these news reports about something, a whole different kind of country in which people are killing each other over religion.
Yeah, there's a lot of it. Well, there's a lot of people killing each other over religion in many, many kind of parts of the world. But in India, there's 1.3 billion people. We know that. How many medals did they win in the Olympics? Do you know?
Well, are they sports oriented other than cricket?
1.3 billion people, you would have thought they won three medals. And one of them was shooting an air gun. So that was the goal, was shooting an air gun. So the two others, we don't know. But that's a pretty pathetic showing. You would have thought, can't anyone run in this country? 40% of Indians live below the poverty line. You say, well, 40%, that's bearable. Oh, but there's 1.3, it's 40% of 1.3 billion earning a dollar a day.
That's half a billion people.
That's a half a billion people who are living in abject poverty. So the miracle, the Indian miracle, is amazing. Yes, there are billionaires. We have billionaires, they say. They have Maseratis. They have Rolls Royces. But also that's the foreground, the Maserati. In the background, you just see a guy with a buffalo plowing a field.
Didn't you run into Prince Charles in India?
I did.
Now, you'd lived in London. Did you have to go to India to bump into him?
You don't bump into him in London. You don't bump into him usually anywhere. But he was staying in the same place that I was staying in, and I had just arranged to bump into him. And if you're writing a travel book, you want to bump into as many people as possible, Arthur C. Clarke, Orhan Pamuk, and Prince Charles and Lady Camilla. So I did. I arranged to bump into them just so that I could. I just wanted that experience. And also, he was in India, and his wife had never been to India before, and I thought this might be kind of funny.
Was it difficult for you to get a visa to visit Myanmar? First of all, do you call it Myanmar or do you call it Burma?
I call it Burma, but no, it was no problem getting a visa there, but it really is a benighted place. And I will say, if the place that had changed the least was Burma. The place that had changed the most was probably Vietnam. But Burma is still a military tyranny, and people have absolutely no rights, no money, no future, nothing.
Are they afraid to speak openly?
Yeah, they whisper, but they really they audibly, in a whisper, but audibly, all to a person, say how much they hate the government.
Had the capital been moved into the hinterlands by that time?
Yes, it had, but that's not an interesting place. The life is in mainly in the cities there, in Mandalay and Rangoon. And in the places, see, I wanted to try to meet people that I had met before. But in Burma, I met a couple of people that I had met before in Upper Burma, who I met that they were the, I had met them when they were kids, and they're now, you know, middle-aged men. And I knew their father. They were running a place up in a town called Mamio.
And you said Vietnam has changed the most.
Well, if you can imagine a country that had 7 million tons of bombs dropped on it and 20 million gallons of defoliant, as it had in 1973 when I was there, and then now it's a flourishing economy. Yeah, that's a big war and peace. It's the big change.
Were people surprised that you were traveling by train? Don't most people fly if they can?
The Vietnamese tend to take the train because there's a lovely train that goes from Ho Chi Minh City all the way north to Hanoi and continues northerly to a place called Lao Cai. Lao Cai is right on the Chinese border. And then you can continue up to Kunming, as I did, and then you can go by train from Ho Chi Minh City to London, for that matter, and never leave a train.
What can you tell about a country by the state of its trains and its train stations?
I came from the Acela Express. You know, we're in New York now. I came from Providence to New York. It's the quickest, most convenient way. 10 or 20 years ago, it wouldn't have been the most desirable way of going. Now it is. What can you tell is that where the trains are good, you see that people are actually building for the future. They're building for a future where, you know, the car really is an unfeasible way of
going. But we see the other thing happening in some countries. The British railway system has been in a serious state of decline. 30 or 40 years ago, it was one of the great glories of Europe, and now you're afraid of crashes. No trains ever leave on schedule.
They've privatized them too. Short-sighted, but take that same analogy. There are more in Holland, more in Germany, probably more in France. In Italy, you'd be a fool to drive in Italy. There's so many trains.
Well, would you have come back with a very different book if you had traveled by car or by bus?
Yes, I would. If I'd traveled by car or bus, I wouldn't have met so many people. I wouldn't have it's very kind of inefficient way of traveling. You can sleep on a train. You can ride on a train. You can walk around. You eat the national food on a train. You can get off wherever you like. You're totally unencumbered, so your mind is freer. And so traveling on a train is, you know, it's relaxing. Your mind is kind of open.
Can you also write while you're on the train? Were you working on this book?
Yeah, I wrote most of this book on the train. Yeah. I mean, that was what the posture I had adopted with the Great Railway Bazaar. I'm starting this book on a train, and then at the end of the trip, and now my train is coming into the station, and the book is done. I actually did write the whole time.
You write that travel means depending on the kindness of strangers. You weren't quoting Tennessee Williams, I'm sure, but still, was it harder to trust people now than it was 30 years ago?
I don't think so. It's the same world, to tell you the truth, I had a much harder time in Vietnam during the war than I did. Vietnam is a very forgiving, merciful country.
Well, were people, when they found out you were American, were they angry with you because there's so much anti-Americanism?
No, I even said, I said, are you angry? Do you hate me? They said, no, that was another time. Those your leaders, they misled you. But the point is, in all travel of the kind that I'm doing, which is basically grinning like a dog, wandering aimlessly, you get in a car. The man can drive you off the road and rob you. It could have happened so many times on the trip. I could have had a very, very bad time, but I didn't. I'm the fortunate traveler in one respect, but also everyone realizes that you're not responsible for what your government does. And if you don't look like your money on two legs, and I don't, then you can have a great time.
Paul Theroux has published a slew of novels, a bunch of travel books as well. The most recent travel book is Ghost Train to the Eastern Star on the Tracks of the Great Railway Bazaar, published by Houghton Mifflin. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you.